ஓம் மதுவாதாரிதாய தேமதுக்ஷரந்தி சிந்தவக மாத்வேர்ண சந்தோஷதீஹி மதுநக்த முதோஷசி மதுமத் பார்த்திவகம் ரஜக மதுத்யௌரஸ்துன பிதா மதுமானோ வனஸ்பதிர் மதுமாகும் அஸ்து சூரியக மாத்வேர்காவோ பவந்து நக. ஓம் சாந்தி சாந்தி சாந்தி. The topic before us is the harmony of the secular and the spiritual, Swami Vivekananda's educational philosophy. Now, when we study the life and teachings of Swami Vivekananda, we have to remember that he was essentially a monk and not a classic educational thinker or a philosopher like John Dewey or Froebel or Herbart or Pestalozzi or Montessori. He didn't belong to one of the classical line of educational thinkers. But as a monk who thought about human civilization, human needs, and the challenges of modern times, the challenges posed by science and technology, and the challenge faced by the loss of faith in tradition and spiritual values, she was very much concerned about what education should be. So during his travels in India and abroad in Europe and America, he observed many things, many paradigms, many views related to social life, and also he closely studied the education system that prevailed in Europe and America, and especially the kind of education system that enabled, that helped the Western world to make rapid developments in science, in technology, in improving the economic conditions of the people. So with all the problems of science and technology, the science and technology did contribute in a big way towards the improving the lot of the common man in the street. So he was very much concerned, and when he traveled in India after returning from the West, this contrasting picture of Indian and Western social structures. On the one hand, the Western society was able to make rapid strides in social, economic and industrial areas, especially after the discovery of the sea routes and after the Industrial Revolution and after the explosive developments in scientific technology that started happening in the Western world right from the early decades of 18th century onwards, from James Watt onwards. So on the one hand, he was highly impressed by the creative use of science and technology and the benefits of an education system that took care of the secular needs of the people, that helped the improvement of material life in Western world. At the same time, he was also aware of some of the problems of science and technology, that posed the challenges, the problems created by science and technology, the loss of faith in certain traditional values, especially the neglect of humanities, which is a much bigger problem today than it was during Vivekananda's time. We are coming to that. So his criticism was a very creative, constructive criticism. So on the one hand, he admired the innovation, the new ideas, the willingness to take up a new idea and go ahead. All these great merits of Western education system were admired by Vivekananda. See, for example, freedom from hierarchy and the spirit of innovation, and then the humanistic values and equal rights, human rights, egalitarian values, democratic values, all these values which Western education system produced found a great admirer in Swami Vivekananda. And coming to India, it's very interesting, it's very important to understand Vivekananda's own understanding of Indian culture, to understand his educational thought. See, when he traveled in India, walking, mostly walking, sometimes traveling by train, for almost 6 years, more or less, from 1886 to 1893, almost for more than 6 years he traveled in India. So it is said that three different contrasting pictures of Indian tradition, Indian nation, Indian culture used to flash through his mind. The one, the picture of the glorious past of India. When you talk about India's past, those of you who are not students of history should read great historians like Toynbee, Will Durant, all these Western historians, what they wrote about India's history. A country that produced not only great religious geniuses like Buddha or Shankara, and of course in recent times Vivekananda, Sri Ramakrishna and so on, but also great mathematicians like Sangrama, Varahamihira, physicists, Bhaskara and so on. Great medical scientists, which today if you go to Kaiser Hospital, if you go to many of the big hospitals of America, you find some of them do recommend even Ayurvedic medicine. And in fact, the fundamental texts of Ayurveda were written in the 2nd century BC, Vagbhadacharya. And the earlier texts were written around 800 BC. So medical science, metallurgy, if you go to India, you find temples constructed around 1000 BC using absolutely marvelous technology of wielding steel, using absolutely marvelous structure, marvelous methods of architecture, engineering, so on. There are temples in India with 1000 pillars, and it could be divided into sevens. Each one of the seven pillars in each group represent one raga, one tone of Indian music. So you don't need an instrument, you hit all the seven pillars, you get, you know, the seven notations of Indian music. And these go back to 1500 BC. No, you can compare this with Egyptian and Babylonian Assyrian civilizations. So Vivekananda knew that there was a different kind of India once upon a time in the past, which is different from what he saw in the middle of 19th century when he traveled all over India. People were economically poor, socially poor, many of them uneducated, remaining in the darkness of illiteracy and economic poverty. So these contrasting pictures used to flash through his mind. And then when he remembered what he saw in this country, the marvelous use of science and technology to improve the lot of the common man in the streets. So then he thought, what can be an ideal system of education? The one fundamental thesis that he arrived at was this: a harmonious synthesis of the best of the traditional, the spiritual, the ancient, and the best of the modern, the scientific and technological. The best, remember. Because science and technology have their own problems. Scientific dogmatism is no less a danger than religious fanaticism. Scientific fanaticism is as destructive, scientific obsession is as destructive as religious fanaticism. So we need a friction-free, harmonious blending of the best of the traditional and best of the modern. Put in a more simplistic way, the best of the Eastern and the best of the Western. So harmony and synthesis was one of the central teachings of Vivekananda's educational thought system. I can give you one example how this really works in modern times. Now, if we go to Silicon Valley, you find more than 400,000 Indians. And many of them are coming, of course, they are all coming here not inspired by spirituality, but they were inspired by Bill Gates, Henry Ford, Rockefeller, and others. They are their gods and goddesses. And many Americans go to India and sit in a cave, go to Chennai, Madras, which is 55 degrees centigrade, you know, more than 120 Fahrenheit hot, the humid weather. They sit and looking at the picture of Ramana Maharshi who's sitting there in a cave with a loincloth, staring at some transcendental something. And from India, they come here, they want to be like Bill Gates. The photo they keep on the table is Bill Gates' photo. And Americans are keeping the photos of Sri Ramakrishna and Ramana Maharshi on their table. So this transcontinental migration of cultures and civilizations are happening. So that is true. But there are also people who have succeeded in integrating the best of the traditional, the spiritual, the oriental, with the best of the modern. So you can be as professional, as efficient, as a CEO, modern corporate CEO, and at the same time you can practice spiritual values. You can be successful in secular sphere without being a failure in spiritual life. So spirituality and secular life do not fight with each other. They are two sides of the same coin. The coin is the same. But you cannot have a coin with only one side. And then you have no coin at all. So, Vivekananda said, the secular and spiritual constitute two non-contradictory, non-conflicting paradigms of human life. And this was one of his central teachings. Now, if you read Vivekananda, you find something that you don't find in the writings of John Dewey, Herbart, Froebel, Pestalozzi, or Montessori, or even so the Indian education thinkers like Gandhi, Aurobindo, Tagore, and others, Dr. Radhakrishnan included. That is, Swamiji says, we need secular prosperity. We need science and technology. See, Gandhi, that's where he differed from Gandhi. See, Gandhi was not very enthusiastic about science and technology. So Gandhi's education system is called craft-oriented education. So in fact, he recommended a kind of, there is no criticism, you know, I mean, we are objective analysis. So Gandhi recommended a kind of education system where every child will be taught to work with his two hands and have secular prosperity in the world, which is, you can imagine, totally unrealistic. In a country with more than 1.3 billion population, a land area which is less smaller than the land area of the United States. So we can, it's unthinkable. But Vivekananda, on the other hand, says we need the best and the latest of modern industry, heavy industry, which Gandhi didn't like. He wanted cottage industry. Vivekananda wanted the latest modern technology and industry. He would have admired Henry Ford for inventing these assembly lines. As Henry Ford would have found a great supporter in Vivekananda. You know, his idea of making his cars available to the lowest paid employee of his company. So that a car should reach the hands of economically and financially backward sections of population. Vivekananda would have admired. And an Indian philosopher like Tagore, he was a poet also, a great poet, he thought of making use of aesthetic values for education. So he gave a lot of importance to dance, music and things like that. Vivekananda did understand and appreciate that, but he said that's not enough. We need not only heart but also brain and strong hands. So Swamiji says we need the best modern industry and the best modern technology. And there are many letters in which he advocated that Indians should sit at the feet of Western scientists and technologists. And he also said that the Western people also sit at the feet of Sri Ramakrishna and Ramana Maharshi and Shankaracharya. That also he said. So there should be the best, a blending of the best of the traditional, the spiritual, and the best of the modern, the scientific, technological. So you can have an extreme kind of idealism, but it is not utopianism, coupled with an extreme form of realism. That's what you find in Vivekananda. So harmony and synthesis, that was one important point. And one very interesting recommendation that you find in Vivekananda, and that may be a bit mind-boggling, but I want to give importance to that. If you read Vivekananda, you find he talks about Gurukula system. Okay, this is very important. Gurukula system of education. Now, if you read anything about the Gurukula, means you know a kind of educational system, the wisdom or knowledge is imparted through a tradition of teacher-student relationship. Now, this is something that Vivekananda recommends for modern times to solve many of the challenges and problems faced by modern educational systems. You know, to give an example, in modern educational system, which becomes extremely science-obsessed or technology-obsessed, science-oriented and technology-oriented, humanities are completely forgotten. Now, if a child or a student is trained only to use his fingers, fingertips to be more precise, and if that kind of education only helps him to make a few more extra dollars, then how is he going to make use of these extra dollars? Unless you teach the student to handle the knowledge that he gets in a school or a college, you should be able to manage the knowledge. Now, unfortunately, very few Western thinkers, except Herbart, really gave a serious thought to this, the spiritual aspect of education. So he recommended this Gurukula system of education. In the Gurukula system, you don't stop your education at the school. What you learn from the teacher is only 1/4 of the education system or the educational process. It is only 1/4 of the knowledge that you get. So, I mean, you should learn as long as you live. So there's an ancient Sanskrit sloka. Acharya padam adatte padam shishya sumedhaya padam sabrahmacharibhya padam kalakramena. So what it means is, from a teacher or a school or a university, you learn one aspect of 1/4 of knowledge. The second 1/4 comes from your own effort. And then the third 1/4 comes from your own experience interacting with fellow students. In life, as you grow, what you learned at school becomes more and more distinct and clear, and you get a clear understanding of the practical utility of what you learn in school. And there is 1/4 that you get as you grow in this world. Now, this is totally neglected in modern Western education system, where youth and beauty, following the ancient Greco-Roman ideal of life, is admired and worshipped. If you are old, it is not something very... anything old and ancient, it is not worth having. Everyone should remain young, healthy, strong, and beautiful. Now, this is physically impossible. So you people spend enormous amounts of time and energy in trying to reverse metabolism. I mean, instead of trying to sit back and read Aristotle or Plato, they go to beauty parlor, trying to whitening the teeth and blackening the hair, and imagining that they can go back to the priest, they can walk back in time. So Vivekananda said, Padam kalakramayanacha. As you grow old in this life, there is a special kind of wisdom that you acquire. So that's why in ancient India, there was a tradition of graceful retirement. If you look at the Vedic literature, the Upanishad literature, almost 80% of all the great teachers of Vedic tradition were all retired householders, not monks or nuns or mendicants. There's a great misunderstanding among those who don't study the Vedas in the original. Oh, India is a kind of monastic community. Indian civilization came from monks and nuns. Totally, absolutely wrong. All the greatest teachers of the Upanishadic Vedic tradition, at least more than 80% of them, were retired householders. And they were the people who imparted education. So there is a statement in the writings of the most prominent lawgiver of Vedic civilization. The Sanskrit verse is this: Grihastasu yada pashye vali palidam atmanaha apatyasi apatyam tada aranyam samasayet. The verse is this: when an householder finds that his hair is getting gray and his face is getting wrinkled, he should retire to a forest hermitage with his wife and spend the rest of his lifetime in imparting education to the next generation, so that they will be able to train future generation, the future nation, future humanity. And there are many instructions. One of the most famous convocation addresses that comes from an ancient teacher who is a retired householder is Vedamanuchyajarihandevasinamanishasti. This is how it begins. After teaching the Vedas, Vedas doesn't mean just memorization of certain things. Many skills are mentioned here. The teacher gives an education. And one important part of education is related to growing up in the family to be ideal husbands and wives, mothers and fathers, sisters and brothers, how to play multiple role in your life in the family setting, to be an ideal citizen, to be an ideal father and mother. And one of our ancient Sanskrit poet, his name is Kalidasa. He has a very wonderful statement that's related to language. We'll come to that later. He says, how a person is taught to speak, to make use of spoken word and written word, which is the most neglected area of education in modern times. Midam cha saram cha vachopi vakmita. He comes in the Meghaduda, Meghasandesha, one of Kalidasa's books. Means real eloquence is the use of language with moderation, clarity and effectiveness. Not verbiage. That is the definition. So, and Kalidasa, who lived in 2nd century AD, referring to an ancient hermit education system, hermit school, refers to this. He says, the correct use of language where human relationship is looked upon with sanctity, and the words used in human relationship also should be looked upon with a sense of sanctity and sacredness. So, Matrudevo Bhava, Pitrudevo Bhava, Acharya Devo Bhava, Adithi Devo Bhava. Four instructions are primarily given to a student who is leaving, who is departing from the Vedic school, going to society, to marry, to become husbands or wives, mothers and fathers, sisters and brothers. You should look upon your parents, your father and mother, your teacher, and also somebody who happens to visit you, as a guest, with respect and honor. I mean, in a metaphoric language, he says, you should respect the parents as much as you respect God himself. This is a metaphor. It's a kind of, you know, symbolic language. It means you should respect. Now, and he says, a person who forgets his past will lose his future. That's one of the important statements that was repeated again and again in the Vedic convocation. In fact, this statement that I quoted just now, Madhurdeva Bhava, Pitrudeva Bhava, it is part of a convocation that comes from Taittiriya Upanishad, which somewhere 2500 BC. So, how important it is, family institution. If you have an education system where students are taught only basic mechanical skills, which may help him to pile up a huge deposit of dollars, which he doesn't know how to make use of, which may perhaps make him an alcoholic, which may cause degradation. I mentioned this earlier, you know. Kalidasa has another statement. Yavvanam dhana sambatti prabuddham avivekida ekaikam avya anarthaya kumu yatra jadushtayam. He says, that's again part of education system which Kalidasa refers to. Youth, wealth, authority, you are a big CEO, or maybe head of a state, whatever, maybe, or along with that, you don't know how to make use of these gifts. Health is there, you don't know how to make use of it. Youth, you don't know how to make use of. Wealth, you don't know. So, you have got all these qualities, and along with that, no sense of discretion, no knowledge of how to make proper use of what you have. One of these is enough without wisdom. So what happens when you have all these three together, all these four together? Kumu yatra chatushtaya means, suppose a person is young, rich, very powerful, lot of power over others, and absolutely uneducated in the use of his resources. That person will be a menace to himself and the rest of humanity. This also comes from Kalidasa. In Kalidasa's famous play, I'm not quoting exclusively from spiritual literature, which I'm more at home with. I'm quoting from secular poets. Kalidasa was not a spiritual man. Far from it. He was more like Dostoevsky, I would say. Dostoevsky was not a poet. Kalidasa was a poet. If there is a comparison, it's Dostoevsky. And certainly not a spiritual genius by any yardstick. And he says, this Kalidasa says, his early life was certainly not that of a great spiritual man. And he says, if a person is young, rich, powerful, and totally unwise, he becomes a problem to himself and the rest of humanity. And one of the important instructions given in the ancient Vedic system was the use of language, you know. There's a special reason why I'm referring to this. There are many other subjects we can discuss. The reason is, one of the casualties of modern times is the study of humanities and the study of language. People think that language is meant for communication. Now, that is a totally wrong approach to language. Your culture influences your language, and your language also will influence your culture. A person who goes on speaking bad words, using bad vocabulary, cannot end up being a saint. And a person who sincerely, I'm not talking about diplomacy or training for a salesperson, or, you know, if you take a phone, you say, hi, how are you? Everything is fine. Have a wonderful day. I'm not talking about that kind of formal language. I'm talking about real use of language in our daily communication, in the family setting, in our professional life, in normal life situations, not in diplomatic circles. In diplomacy, you know, there is a picture of Adolf Hitler and Neville Chamberlain shaking hands, both are smiling, out-smiling each other. And that was just before the beginning of the Second World War. You know what happened later. Both are smiling. So I'm not talking about diplomacy. I'm talking about genuine use of language with full awareness. And there, the ancient Vedic Gurukula system has some very wonderful things to say. One of our most ancient, in fact, the most ancient Sanskrit poem is Valmiki's Ramayana. They say that is the first full-fledged poetical work, classical poetry in Sanskrit language. There is an interesting definition of an ideal person who uses language properly. How language should be used, how word should be looked upon as something sacred, because it influences our mind, it influences our emotions, our attitudes, our behavior. And our behavior and attitudes also will influence language, both ways. So how language should be used? Because the reason why I'm referring to this is, in modern times, we never give any importance to humanities, study of language, literature, prosody, the great phonetics, all these great areas related to language. And Vivekananda had a special reason why he considered Gurukula system of education, the ancient Vedic system of education, some of those great ideas. You cannot go to a forest and sit there today. You don't have computers in a forest. So today's the latest modern education institutions like Harvard, Stanford, MIT can actually integrate some of these ancient values. Those values are ancient, but they are relevant because they remind you of the precious wealth that we are losing today, every day, as we go ahead neglecting the study of words and language and humanities. So I'm referring to an interesting episode from Valmiki's Ramayana. One of the important characters of this poetical, classical poetry is Hanuman. Hanuman was a great philosopher, a great devotee and a great Vedic scholar in Valmiki. Remember, you may find a picture, Hanuman is a monkey. He was not a monkey, really speaking. Hanuman is the name of a great philosopher. If you have more monkeys like that, world will be much better today, actually. Hanuman is the name of a great philosopher, a great spiritual man. Now, his king sent him as an ambassador to Rama. They wanted to enter a treaty, some kind of an alliance against a common enemy. It has nothing to do with spirituality, but that's the context, it is a secular context I am referring to. So this gentleman, Hanuman, dressed up very well and went to meet these kings. Kings mean both, one is a prince, Lakshmana was a younger prince, Rama was the senior king, the emperor. So Rama won't speak to an ambassador, so he asked his younger brother Lakshmana to speak to the ambassador, to Hanuman. Okay, now we are not referring to the language skills of the prince or the emperor. We are referring to the language skills of a common man like Hanuman. So after a long conversation, this Hanuman was going back to his place, and watching him, Rama says, "Na anurveda vinitasya, na ayurveda dharinaha, na asama veda vidusho shakyamevam prabhashidum, krishnam vyagaranan nunam anena bhukudasudam, bhuku vyagarada anena na kinchit apashabditam." The meaning is this, the ancient verse, you should remember, it says, this man must have studied all the four Vedas, must have studied different schools of ancient Sanskrit grammar. There are 14 important texts on Sanskrit grammar, which somewhere between 3500 BC and 800 BC. There were 14 important traditional classical works on Sanskrit grammar. Krishnam Vyakaranam Nunam. This man must have studied and mastered all these 14 schools of grammar. And he must have studied the entire Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, all the four Vedas. Because he spoke and spoke for a long time. Bahu Vyakarada Anena. He spoke for a very long time, very eloquently. There was not a single misuse or mispronunciation of a word, a single word in his long conversation. That's not enough. Then he says, Namukhe netrayor vapi lalaadecha bruvort sada anyeshabicha gatreshu dosha samvidita kujit avistaram asagdhigdam avilambidam madrudam urastam kandagam vakyam vartade madhimegari. So the point is, not a samskara kramasampannam adrudam avilambidam uchyarebi kalyanim vajam hridayakarinim. The last word is vajam hridayakarini, means as we listen to him, our heart gets filled with joy and blessings. Because he spoke for a long time. There was no misuse, there was no arrogance, no extreme use of words, absolute moderation. There was calm and quiet in a proper language, without exaggerating, with proper moderation, but absolutely calling a spade, that's what it means here, you know, this is it. Asandigdham avilambidam, he didn't hesitate to put words across properly. Now, here, you find, Rama says, when he spoke to us, our heart was filled with joy, because there was so much of refinement, politeness, humility and beauty in his choice of words and in his phonetic skills, I'm talking about pronunciation of words. Now, the point is, this is something totally neglected, and I believe the Swami Vivekananda was aware of these emerging trends, because when Swamiji lived, when Vivekananda lived, we had not become so technology obsessed. Our educational system had not become so utilitarian and so absolutely dollar-oriented, so to speak, to be very precise. Every skill, every bit of knowledge, every bit of information is judged on the basis of how much it can bring to us in terms of enjoyment. Just following fanatically the footsteps of J.S. Mill. J.S. Mill said, you know, the definition of utilitarianism is maximum amount of pleasure that it brings maximum number of people. That should be the yardstick, the criterion for judging anything. Vivekananda said that kind of education can create only monsters, or madmen cannot produce refined, civilized people who are not only educated, but are also endowed with the wisdom to know how to make proper use of that education and how to avoid making improper use of it. So Vivekananda says there is an evolution in the educational process. Information, knowledge, wisdom, and then he didn't mention that, but he implies prajna. There's a fourth stage. So, in an ideal education, it could be any education, anything scientific, technological, even the so-called secular education can have a spiritual orientation if the secular education is coupled with this wisdom. Because wisdom enables us to handle what we learn. Learning doesn't help us necessarily to handle learning. Information doesn't teach us how to make use of information. Knowledge may not teach us how to make use of knowledge. Hitler's Germany was technologically the most advanced nation in the late 30s. And you know what happened. So education frequently takes us backward in civilization and in refinement. As we become more educated, we become more crude and more rude and more inhuman. That's why In ancient way, Gurukula system that Swamiji refers to, every student has to go through a kind of formal ceremony, a kind of what you call initiation, which means you are introduced to the world of knowledge, the world of letters. So knowledge in its higher dimension, wisdom or prajna, was deified and called a goddess. Now, we often oppose this idea. I have had encounters with many monotheists who tell you, or how can learning be goddess? What it means is, learning should be done and approached with a sense of sanctity and sacredness. That is what it implies. The moment you consider learning, the moment you consider the words we use and to write and to speak with a sense of sanctity and sacredness, and then it becomes something that sustains us, the sustained civilization, refinement and culture. Otherwise, that learning can lead to the mass destruction, the destruction of humanity. In fact, modern man is endured with enough weapons to destroy the world several times, one after another. That's why, C.P. Snow, one film writer, said, the Second World War was fought with, of course, atomic weapons to the end. The Third World War will be fought with hydrogen bombs. The Fourth World War will be fought with bows and arrows, because you have to begin again from the caveman stage. So that shows education, scientific and technological education, minus humanities, minus the higher wisdom, is not only not creative, it is positively destructive. So the ancient, there's a prayer, in the invocation, it's called invocation of Gayatri Avahana Mantra. That's what it is called. So in ancient times, the Swamiji refers to Gurukula system, a student has to get up in the morning, turn to the east at the rising sun, and just utter a mantra. The mantra is, Aya Duvarada Devi Aksharam Brahma Samvidam Gayatri Chandasa Madhidam Brahma Jushaswami Ojosi Sahosi Belamasi, etc. I don't want to repeat the whole thing. What it means is, O Mother of Learning and Wisdom, please bless me, please come to me. Please sit on my tongue and help me to make proper use of the sacred word symbols. This is a kind of prayer. Now, this prayer, it doesn't imply polytheism or some kind of pantheism, as many people put it that way. But what it means is, we look upon education as something creative and constructive. That's why Vivekananda says, education, education, education alone, Swamiji says. And Vivekananda has something very interesting to say about what he saw in the United States, the transformative education that he found. That is something very interesting for us to look back and remember. He found something very interesting happening in the United States before his own eyes as he was traveled all over this country. He came to this country in 1893, and he lived on here. He left for Europe and again he came back. So he spent quite some time in this country. Twice he went back and again he came. So he says about what he saw and what transformative impact education can have on the mindset of people in the area of secular life, social life. He says, education, education, education alone. Traveling through many cities of Europe and observing in them the comforts and education of even the poor people, there was brought to my mind the state of our own poor people, and I used to shed tears. What made the difference? Education was the answer. He's referring to what he saw in India, where education was not widespread. Remember, if you look at Indian history, India walked several thousands of miles backward as it marched from 3000, 4000 BC to 19th century. So remember, civilization doesn't always go forward. It sometimes comes backward also. If you look at Greece, look at Rome, today Europe may not be able to produce a Socrates or Aristotle, Plato. What does it mean? Europe has walked backward in civilization. This happens to many ancient civilizations. Look at Egypt, today's Egypt, and ancient Egypt, today's Assyria, and ancient Assyria and today's Iran, Iraq, of course. So civilization doesn't necessarily move forward, it walks backward. Swamiji says, in New York, I used to observe the Irish colonists come. In those days, people used to come from Ireland. They were neglected, they were poor. They used to come and Swamiji observed them. In New York, I used to observe the Irish colonists come, downtrodden, haggard looking, destitute of all possessions at home, penniless and wooden headed, with their only belongings, a stick and a bundle of rags hanging at the end of it, fright in their steps, fear in their steps, alarm in their eyes. Then Swamiji says, a different spectacle in 6 months. In his eyes and steps, there is no more sign of fright. Within 6 months, as they come to this country, as they find a different place where they can learn, they are not constrained as they were in Ireland. At that time, this free, huge, rich, new continent gave them hope. That's what Swami is referring to. Then he says, a different spectacle in 6 months. The man walks upright. His attire is changed. In his eyes and steps, there is no more sign of fright. What is the cause? Or Vedanta says that that Irish man was kept surrounded by contempt, not given any education in his own country. The whole nature was telling him with one voice, Pat, you have no more hope. You are born a slave and will remain so. So if you are told that you are bad and worthless by everyone around you, you will eventually become that. That's what Swamiji says. When they came to this country, they found new hope, new resources, and they became free. That's why Vivekananda's definition of education is very interesting. Education is the manifestation of perfection already in man, already in all of us. Man doesn't mean man alone, it means man and women both. Old language. So Swamiji says, education is the manifestation of perfection already in man. Just the opposite of what John Locke said, tabula rasa. There is perfection already. John Locke said, it's an empty slate. Vivekananda says, the slate is full. You have to just manifest. Swamiji says, education is the manifestation of perfection already. Man. Some of the definitions of education from John Dewey and Herbart and Froebel sometimes echo some of these great ideas. That means there is an inherent potential in all of us. Education brings out that potential. Just like, you know, if you have a huge granite stone, if you are a sculptor, and you, what you do after working for 6 months, you get a Buddha of granite. The Buddha was hidden in the granite block. You chiseled out all unnecessary parts, and then Buddha manifests. Like that, and in the Yoga Sutra, there is a statement, Kshetrika means, once you remove all the obstacles, then the rest will take care of itself. So if there is a pond or a lake somewhere and a field which you want to irrigate, what do? You just cut a canal, which means you remove that part of the soil, and when the soil is removed, it becomes a canal and water flows to the field. So once you remove the obstacles, the rest will take care of itself. So you find that the 18th century, the early German education like Herbart and then later Froebel, even later thinkers like Pestalozzi, Montessori had some of these ideas, and also John Dewey. Education is life itself. That's a great definition given by the great American educationist John Dewey. That's why Vivekananda says education is a manifestation of perfection that is already there. It doesn't come out. Knowledge doesn't come from outside. Knowledge comes from within. So, in other words, Swamiji's thought, education is a kind of negative process, which I mentioned to you earlier. You know, when you have a granite block, and if you're a sculptor, what do? You take an instrument, a tool, and you remove all these unnecessary parts of the granite block, it's chiseled out, and what you get at the end of the day is a statue of Buddha. Like that, education is nothing but removing all the obstacles. Once the obstacle is removed, then the reality within already manifests itself. Vivekananda said again and again, for this kind of education to be meaningful, you need one very important quality, which in Sanskrit is called Shraddha. So throughout his writings again and again, and also in his letters to his disciples, both monastic and lay disciples, Swamiji talks about this fundamental quality called Shraddha. So Shraddha is a very interesting. Shraddha can be defined as a combination of a sense of sanctity, sacredness, intense identification of what you do or what you study, with a great reverence for it, and not looking at it as something that can help you to get a few extra dollars, but knowledge as its own value, even if it doesn't in any way help us to get any material benefit. We study only that which we learn, fully knowing that it is not going to benefit us materially. That's an important thing to remember. We can really study and master only that we study without any purpose behind. That's why great lawyers write poetry. They would like to be identified as a poet, not as a lawyer. A great doctor, if he's a mystic, he would be proud of the books he's studying on mysticism and not the number of patients he's treating, if he's a genuine student of mysticism. So what we study and what we do for its own sake, without the thought of what material benefit we are going to get out of it, that only we study. So that kind of a sense of sanctity, sacredness, intense reverence, and study for its own sake. These are some of the aspects of called Shraddha. When we have this Shraddha, one very fundamental and practical benefit of having this Shraddha is it kills all skepticism and doubt. Because that's the greatest enemy in learning anything. Skepticism and doubt. When you learn something, good for nothing, still I have to study this. That kind of learning we may get some material benefit, but we don't really master that art or skill. When we don't have a sense of sanctity and sacredness for what we learn, and also sanctity, a kind of reverence for the one who teaches you. That's why, you know, in the Bhagavad Gita, there's a great disclaimer and a great warning rolled into one. Idam te na tapaskaya na bhaktaya kadajana na sasrushave vakyam na yomam abhyasuyati. So Lord Krishna, after teaching all the 18 chapters, this comes the 18th chapter, towards the end of the text, 700 verses, comes towards the end, not the last one, but comes closer to the end. He says, don't teach this to somebody who has no self-control and who has no sense of sanctity and sacredness and devotion, and who criticizes you after you teach him. It means, suppose you are a professor in a university, you are a teacher, or a school teacher, that may be much more lively scene, which often frequently happens. If you are a teacher in a high school, and after making a lot of preparations, you love the students, you worry about their grades, and then suddenly you happen to overhear them talking about this teacher is good for nothing, but it is also worthless. Now, Lord Krishna tells you, don't teach him anything. Of course, in secular area where you are paid for your work, and the student is paying his tuition free, you have to do it. But Vivekananda says, Lord Krishna says, and Swamiji agrees with that, that kind of learning is not always helpful. If you want a real explanation, psychological explanation, spiritual explanation for the terrible things that frequently happen in these school campuses, where teachers, students go wild. They become violent. They become aggressive. That's because they are being taught things which they didn't like. And they are being taught by people whom they didn't like. They were studying in places where they didn't want to be. So you can just imagine, suppose you are not at all interested in music. And every day your parents drag you to a music teacher and force you to learn music. You will become an enemy of your parents and also of music. You become a lifelong enemy of music and also your parents. That's what will happen. That's why Vivekananda says, education to be effective, fruitful and useful, not only the one who learns and also the one who teaches, it should have a kind of sraddha on the part of the student and also the teacher. If you have sraddha, then you'll be able to convert information into knowledge, and knowledge into wisdom, and wisdom into what we call in Sanskrit prajna, which is higher, refined spiritual insight, a kind of inner spiritual insight, intuition. Is called prajna. Something that helps you to learn exactly what it implies, what it means. So, that's why if you read Vivekananda's books, you can find many such wonderful gems, which can be a great contribution, which are many paradigms of educational thought system you find in Vivekananda. He was a monk, but you know, an ideal monk should also be very, very sensitive to the needs of the society, the needs of human civilization, should be able to understand the problems of modern society. And Vivekananda, even at that time, in fact, in 19th century, the late 19th century, last decade of 19th century, during which Vivekananda traveled in this country, things were far better than they are now. We had an Emerson, we had a Whitman, we had a Thoreau, all these great men. Of course, we had civil war also, by what I mean. But this we should remember, these great thinkers, mystics, transcendentalists, who think of something transcendental, something that's beyond this world, that belongs to another realm, some transcendental values they had. So there were certainly great men and great women in those days who cared and who considered these ideas to be sacred and important. So today's modern education system, all over the world, you find they worship the dollar. They worship the rich. Dollars is needed. Riches, wealth is needed. Vedanta cannot and should not and does not neglect the needs of the common person. Wealth is required, as need science and technology, wealth and prosperity. Secular things are needed. But secular wisdom, secular education by itself can be a serious problem, can lead to the liquidation of wiping out the entire humanity and human civilization. As I mentioned, you know, if there is another war, it will be fought with hydrogen bombs. The fourth war will be fought with bows and arrows. Humanity will go back to the cave, the stage of caveman. So that's why Swamiji said the secular should be blended with the spiritual. The spiritual gives you insight. The spiritual enables you to make proper and intelligent use of the powers and gifts that we get from science and technology and secular education. And it helps us to know where it should stop, its limit. So I shall conclude by referring to an interesting paradigm of comparing the best of the secular and the best of the spiritual in educational system. It comes from, again, it comes from the in the Bhagavad Gita. It is called the ideal of a Rajarshi. So in the fourth chapter of the Gita, those who are interested can refer to. Otherwise, don't bother, I shall explain in English. In the fourth chapter, the beginning, there is a verse, Imam Vivasude Yogam Proktavanaham Avayam Vivasvan Manave Praha Manu Ikshagvaya Bravit Evam Parampara Praptam Imam Rajasya Vidhu Sakali Nehamahada Yogo Nashta Parantava. This interesting and comprehensive way of blending the best of the traditional and the modern, the best of the spiritual and religious, and the best of scientific and technological, the best of the secular and spiritual. This was practiced in ancient times, but it somehow was lost. What was he saying? Rajarshi. You should be a king when it comes to efficiency, enthusiasm, when it comes to your ability to acquire secular things, secular needs and secular tools for life. You should be efficient, like a CEO, like a big company executive, or like king. Raja means king. But symbolically it means secular prosperity. And education that enables you to acquire secular prosperity. Rishitvam means, Rishitvam tasyaha sukshmartha darsana kshamatvam. That's a definition by Shankarananda Saraswati, one of the commentators, says, Rishitvam means the status, the wisdom of a sage, the wisdom of a saint, a sage or a philosopher, like Plato or Socrates. What is that wisdom? The ability to understand where secular prosperity stops. The ability to understand, to go beyond the secular, not neglecting the secular, not neglecting the material needs, but the ability to know where it stops, where its limit, the ability to be aware of its limits. So once we are aware of its limits, we don't run away from it, but we will not go after it as a mad person. We won't be mad after it. To be obsessed with secular prosperity and neglecting all that is spiritual is to be avoided. That's why the harmonious blending without any friction of the best of the secular and best of the spiritual, that should be the guiding philosophy of education in modern times. This, in essence, this is Vivekananda's message. Thank you. Namaskar. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Paramastu.